Since you're listening to Scanna, I'm pretty sure you love whales. But how far would you go to save a whale? Captain Paul Watson has risked his life for whales again and again and again and again. One of the biggest challenges to saving the world is there is so little agreement on how to save it. When I saw that Paul Watson had been tossed out of the Sea Shepherd Society, the organization he didn't just found, but to many people, including me, he was the spirit, soul, and heart of, it was Paul Watson in action, I had two thoughts. Oh no. Not again. Hi, I'm Mark Laren Young, and welcome to Scanna, for fans of fact-based reality and reality-based facts. Now, before we dive into this interview, I think it's important that I be very transparent about this fact. I am a huge fan of our guest. An interview I did with Paul Watson from Acclaim's magazine, this was Canada's biggest, only, and essential news magazine, back in 1996, led to me writing my book, The Killer Whale Who Changed the World, which led to Scanna, which you're listening to now, and all of the books and movies about whales and sharks that I've written ever since. Paul Watson actually wrote the introduction to one of these books, Sharks Forever. Now, I don't usually mention this here, but I pay more of my bills writing TV and movies than I do writing and talking about endangered orcas and oceans. And if I could write a movie about anyone alive, it'd be Paul Watson. If you want to listen to a debate over how many endangered species can fit on the head of a pin, just see what happens if you say Paul Watson was one of the founders of Greenpeace, been there, recycled the t-shirt. Well, there is no rational argument, and hey, if you'd like to hit me with an irrational one, please do, because that's what social media is for. Paul Watson was one of the earliest and most famous faces of Greenpeace. He showed up when Greenpeace switched from fighting against nukes to fighting for whales. Since then, he has consistently risked his life for whales and seals and all sorts of other kinds of marine life. I'm going to repeat that because one of the reasons people will follow Paul into the fire or really into oceans that can be far scarier than any fire is that he has repeatedly put his whole body where his mouth is. Now, if you're listening to Scanna, I'm pretty sure you're a fan of whales. Maybe you'd donate to help him out. If so, feel free to visit our Patreon page because we've got a lot of orca stories coming up and we'd be telling so many more if we had even a few more sponsors, or at least subscribe to our Substack newsletter, which features bonus stories about all the aquatic animals and issues we cover. Hey, maybe you'd march for whales. Maybe. Just maybe. You'd even be willing to get arrested in an act of civil disobedience to help protect orcas and their habitat. But would you stand between a harpoon and a whale? At age 73, Paul Watson is about to do that again, with a new organization, Neptune's Pirates. He's also working with branches of the Sea Shepherd that have split from the Sea Shepherd mothership. As always, lots of links to deep dive into this on our Scanna homepage. The last interview I did with Paul Watson for Scanna was in person at the Friday Harbor Film Festival, where both our documentaries won major awards. For this interview, I was home in Saanich, Lekwungen and Wasanich territory in Canada, and Paul Watson was in France, about to hop on board another ship to fight another campaign. A heads up that despite the valiant work of audio engineer Bug Lewis, there are a few computer noises that seem determined to be a part of this interview. I know, maybe they're a secret message from the whales. Paul and I talked about who and what he's fighting for. I can't stress enough that whales are who's, not what's. And also, what the hell just happened? How are you and where are you?
Oh, in Paris, living in Paris.
How did Paris happen?
Oh, I'm working closely with Sea Shepherd France. And, you know, after this whole big illegal dismissal that they threw me out of Sea Shepherd, then this is one group that was loyal to me, that and Brazil.
So you're actually working with Sea Shepherd, but only Sea Shepherd France and Brazil?
Yeah. They're the only two that remain loyal to the original objectives of Sea Shepherd. You know, the others all sold out. They've gone mainstream, getting corporate and government sponsorship, that kind of thing.
How did that happen?
Well, they slowly took over. It was just one little piece at a time, beginning in 2019, putting this person on the board, that person on the board. You know, back in 2019, when I sent a boat to Iceland, I was starting to get problems. They were saying, well, you know, this is going to upset some of the governments we're trying to work with, and we're rebranding. And then they said, basically, they said I was too controversial and too confrontational. They offered me $300,000 a year just to do nothing. Be a figurehead. Say nothing, post nothing, don't give any talks, don't do any interviews.
Isn't controversial and confrontational kind of the brand?
Yeah, that's what they'd like to keep that appearance, but that's not what they're doing. They haven't done a single confrontation since I left. They sell the Jolly Roger flag on merchandise, but they don't fly it on the ships anymore because it upsets their African partners.
Wow, okay.
Well, the worst thing they did was Sea Shepherd Australia is in partnership with Austral Fisheries, which is a company owned by 50% owned by Marua Dachiro, a Japanese fishing company. And suddenly our policy changed from opposing commercial fishery to now supporting so-called sustainable fishery, although Austral Fisheries tooth fishing is not sustainable. You know, it just sold out. These guys, because of the success of Whale Wars, we brought in quite a bit of money, and that ended up people getting jobs and job security, and then they decided that I was a threat to their job security.
Wow. When I was reading about this, I couldn't even wrap my head around it, because I remember our conversations about you splitting with Greenpeace, and I just thought, how in the world could this happen again?
Yeah, well, right? Because I trusted these people. These are people I've known for years and years, and I trusted them. What happened in August of 2022, they held a meeting, which I wasn't invited, and Lamia Salami, the president of Sea Shepherd France, wasn't invited. And they made a decision without a discussion, without a vote of the full board, the global board, they made a decision to dismiss me. And they informed me that by email on September 2nd and have refused to respond to us ever since. And except for suing us, Sea Shepherd Global's been suing us, saying we have no right to use the logo or the name, you know, in Sea Shepherd France. And Sea Shepherd USA sued me personally, saying I have no right to, for instance, I have no rights to use any historical photographs. They shut down my Facebook page because I had a picture of me wearing a Sea Shepherd shirt with a Sea Shepherd flag. They said that was a copyright violation, trademark violation. They're just basically ruthless opportunists, really, comes right down to it. But the worst thing about it is that they're just doing nothing but pretending to do things. So they've really betrayed the objectives. I set up Sea Shepherd as a movement of independent international entities, and we set up Sea Shepherd Global in 2013 only for operation of the ships and the campaigns. And now Sea Shepherd Global has taken over and told all the other entities that they're in charge. And so these four men have decided that they control everything and everybody has to do what they say. And companies like Sea Shepherd New Zealand, Germany, and Italy, they all go along with it because Sea Shepherd Global says, well, then you can't use the name and you can't use the logo, and basically we'll fire you.
How many Sea Shepherds are there?
Well, we had groups in probably about 20 different countries.
And they're each sort of individual, so that's how you can be...
Yeah, they're all individual entities. And I was on the board of all of them, except I got kicked off of them all. I got kicked off the Australian board for questioning. I said, what the hell are you doing in a partnership with Austral Fisheries and working with a fishing company? And they refused to answer my questions, and then they just voted to dismiss me.
Wow. Now, I remember the last time we talked, you weren't allowed to leave the States. Or there was a risk to you leaving the States.
Well, I could always go to France. I could always go to France because the French government had no problem with it at all. But now the Interpol red notice has been dropped, so now I'm free to travel.
Okay. Was there ever an explanation for why the red notice was dropped?
Nope. Just suddenly it wasn't there anymore.
Can you explain, because I know what a red notice is, but can you explain what a red notice is? Because it's amazing to me that you were an international fugitive.
Yeah, well, in 2012, I was stopped at the Frankfurt airport on an extradition request by Costa Rica for interfering with the shark finning operation in the waters of Guatemala, which I did, by the way, at the request of the Guatemalan government. But when we got to Costa Rica, I was charged with 8 counts of attempted murder by these fishermen who put in a complaint. Nobody was injured. Nothing was damaged. And we went to trial, but fortunately I had Rod Stewart on board and he had filmed everything. So we just showed the footage and the court dismissed the charges. Then a week later, I was charged again with 8 counts of attempted assault. And we went to court and then showed the film and the charges were dismissed and I was given permission to leave. And I didn't think anything of it until 10 years later when I landed in Germany. And then I was charged with something called shipwreck endangerment. Nobody really knows what that means, but it's actually a terrorist threat or something. So the Germans arrested me and held me under house arrest for 2 months. And while I was under house arrest, Japan put in a request for extradition on the charge of conspiracy to trespass on a whaling ship. Not even trespassing, conspiracy to trespass. At the end of July, after 2 months, I got a call from a supporter in the Ministry of Justice in Germany who said that when I report to the police station, which I had to do every day, that when I reported on this Monday, that I would be then arrested and sent to Japan. And so I left Germany on the Sunday, just before the Monday, and went to the Netherlands, got on a sailing boat, sailed across the Atlantic, didn't have any papers, no passport or anything, landed at night in Nova Scotia, then crossed into the U.S., crossed the United States, reboarded the Bridge of Bardot off of Catalina Island, took the Bridge of Bardot to American Samoa, and boarded the Steve Irwin, went down and did the campaign in the Southern Ocean, and then came back in Tasmania, transferred back to the Bridge of Bardot, then went and spent the next 6 months in exile in the South Pacific Islands, Vanuatu, Tonga, places, until Secretary of State John Kerry gave me permission to return, saying that the charges were basically bogus. But I did all this without any papers. You know, I had no passports or anything. So what happened is after I left Germany, Interpol gave Costa Rica and Japan their request for a red notice. And a red notice means that anywhere you go, when you enter a country, that country can detain you and try you for extradition to whatever country put in that request. So the two countries that I was safe in was the U.S. and France. But anywhere else, and it could never do. I could show up, say, in Mexico, and they could arrest me and send me there. The only other country I was able to go into was Ireland, because Ireland doesn't allow extradition unless you've actually been convicted of a crime. So, but anyway, I was 10 years on the Interpol red notice, and just recently it was lifted. It just wasn't there, and there was no explanation as to why.
How did you find out you were no longer a wanted man?
Oh, every once in a while, you check on the Interpol list to see if you're on there.
Wow. Now, it's my understanding that is like reserved for like the worst of the worst criminals. Like this is not a standard thing.
The red notice is issued for war criminals, major drug traffickers, and serial killers. And I'm the only person in the history of the red notice to be put on there for trespassing, actually conspiracy to trespass. And the other charge in Costa Rica was for something called shipwreck endangerment. But in 2017, with the change of government in Costa Rica, they dropped the charges against me, which shows you how politically it was. If it was judicial, they wouldn't have been able to do that. But with a change of government, they dropped it. And actually, the environment minister of Costa Rica called me and apologized for what the previous government had done. So, yeah, it was all very political.
What's fascinating to me is it felt like you had shifted to the point where Sea Shepherd, like, you'd made the brand international. You were being, your work was being respected and taken seriously. So it kind of blows my mind that anything would shift after that. So this really was the TV show changed attitudes or?
What happened in 2015 is Peter Hammarstedt decided to work with these African governments, you know, to help stop poaching in their waters. And that was fine. But then these African governments began to complain. They complained, well, you know, we don't want to be associated if you're sinking whaling boats. We don't want to be associated with the Jolly Roger flag. So what they decided, well, you know, we want to work with these governments. Although I started to question, why are you working with the governments? Because they proudly boast, we've arrested 80 fishing boats in African waters. But when Lamia Essam-Lamy began to ask questions, because she was putting €1 million a year from Sea Shepherd France into that project, she said, well, what happens to these boats when you arrest them? Because our understanding is that they're not held for more than 2 weeks, and then they're released, they're given very minor fines, and they're back out on the ocean fishing again. And again, they refused to answer Lamia's questions. When she kept asking the questions, she was dismissed from Sea Shepherd Global, the same way I was. What they want to do is have the appearance of actually being this hardcore, direct action, aggressive, but they don't want to actually do it because it upsets the governments. Right now, two of their ships, and actually it was three, were given free berths in the government dock in Namibia, in Balas Bay. Actually, free berths. The ships have been there, out of there, working there for the last year. 100 kilometers from Balas Bay is the second largest seal hunt on the planet, killing the South African fur seals. They have said nothing about it. They don't do anything about it because they don't want to upset the Namibian government. So we just recently did a campaign into Namibia, and we had to actually sneak around Sea Shepherd, you know, the Captain Paul Watson Foundation did, to sneak around Sea Shepherd to get this evidence, because we knew they'd probably turn us into the Namibian government if they knew that we were there. But I think the most egregious thing they've done is partnered with the Austral Fishing Company. Austral Fisheries sold them one of their ships for a discount price and threw in 500 tons of fuel as a donation, and also gave other donations. And the CEO of Austral Fisheries is the cycling buddy with Jeff Hansen, who's the director of Sea Shepherd Australia. And that's when Sea Shepherd Australia, about 2 years ago, began saying, well, you know, we're all for sustainable fishing. Austral Fisheries is a sustainable fishing company, which it is not. But I think that Sea Shepherd Australia is well played by Austral Fisheries, because in the 2015 Chasing of the Thunder, Austral Fisheries sent one of their big boats to come alongside the Sam Simon and the Bob Barker off the coast of Africa to say, we support what you're doing. And after that, began to move in and support Sea Shepherd Australia and Sea Shepherd Global. You know, they got seduced by the money, I guess. And also, well, the other thing is that the CEO of Austral Fisheries, David Carter, was able to get tax charitable status for Sea Shepherd Australia, which they were unable to do for 5 years. But with his help, they got it. And of course, that meant bringing a lot more money and donations. So the short answer is they were compromised and they sold out.
How, I mean, I want to get to what you're doing now, but how hard, well, like when I saw this happening, when I started seeing this on your Facebook page, first, I couldn't believe this. And second, I thought, how can you even be going through this again? Like, how hard was this on you to go through this again?
Well, it was difficult at first because, I mean, they took my ships, they took our assets. You know, the other thing they took is that their people leave bequests to Sea Shepherd. You know, this is like millions of dollars. So they grabbed hold of that too. And they took hold of their list of supporters. So I had absolutely nothing in September of 2022. What I did have, however, was the loyalty of longtime supporters and veteran crew members. And one of them, Jean-Paul DeJoria, called me up and he said, what's going on? I said, well, this is what's happening. Because he had a boat that he had sponsored called the Jean-Paul DeJoria in Mexico. So he called them up and said, what happened to my boat? Because they scrapped all those boats. And he was told, well, they were getting old, which they weren't. And he said, well, why didn't you just give it to Paul? They said, well, we offered it to him, but he refused it. And I said to Jean-Paul, no, that's not true. They haven't even talked to me, so it was never offered. So he said, yeah, find a ship and I'll buy it for you, which is what I did. And we found the vessel in a Scottish patrol vessel in England, and he bought it for us, and we renamed it the Jean-Paul DeJoria. And so now we had a ship, and then we started to get a lot of people. By word of mouth, when people find out what they did, they come over. But the problem is reaching people to let them know what happened, because they control the membership list and everything. So that's been the difficulty. But we've built it up, so we've gotten, you know, literally tens of thousands of supporters over the last 2 years. So it's been working out well that way. And we'll rebuild it. You know, we had to suffer a lawsuit. Sea Shepherd USA sued us. That cost us quite a bit to defend ourselves. And now Sea Shepherd Global is suing us. And we won in the Dutch courts. And they said that the dismissal of Lamy and I was illegal, but nothing happened. It was just a ruling. And now they're suing us, saying we don't have the rights to use the name or the flag, even though I created the name and I designed the logos. Now they're claiming that I didn't design the logos, that Geert Bons, one of the directors, designed it, but he wasn't even involved until 2000. And the logos were designed in 85 and in 91. So there's a lot of blatant lying going on here, but I'm confident that the courts will see through that, because we presented the evidence so that I created the logos. So I think we should win on that one. And if we don't, then something's really strange, because the evidence is there.
I'm just wondering how you wrapped yourself around all of this when it started to happen, when things started to fall apart.
Well, you do what you have to do, and that is, you know, keep going. There's nothing else that you can do. you know, a lot of people complain that I'm being critical of Sea Shepherd, but of course I'm being critical of Sea Shepherd. It's the only way that I can reach people to tell them what's going on so that they're not taken in by this charade, which is what it is, because they haven't done anything since I've left. The most recent thing is that they've gone down twice to Antarctica to take pictures of krill fishing vessels, which is something Greenpeace did in 2018, which is something that National Geographic did also in 2018. So there's nothing new there. They didn't interfere with the operations. They just took pictures. Now they're returning to do a fundraising tour of Australia, calling it the Great Antarctic Defense Campaign. And I said, all you did, guy, was take pictures. And that's all they're doing now. They're afraid to do confrontations because their sponsors now include Allianz Insurance Company, Lloyd's of London, various the Dutch and German postal code lotteries, and of course these government partnerships that they have with about a dozen African countries, plus also Mexico. And they were trying to, what was really weird is while I was on the board and Lamy were on the board, they made a decision to send the Bob Barker to Israel without telling us. And when the boat ended up in Israel, I said, what are you doing in Israel? And, well, we're going into a partnership with Israel to patrol their waters for illegal fishing. I said, this is ridiculous. It's 170 miles of the most heavily defended coastline on the planet. And who are you going to defend it from? Palestinian fishermen? Is this what this is all about? But they wouldn't respond. But basically what it was is get their foot into the door so they could get donations in Israel. And then they took the Bob Barker and they had it scrapped in Turkey. And I said, why'd you do that? Well, it was getting old. I said, what you do when you have an old ship is what I did with my two ships. You take them on a campaign and you sacrifice them. You should have taken that ship to the Faroe Islands. The Faroese said that any Sea Shepherd ship that comes into their waters will be seized. You should have sent it to the Faroe Islands and had it seized. Great publicity, and that would have taken care of your problem on how to retire the vessel. Then it's their problem. You know, I did that in Canada twice. I retired a vessel by having the government seize it, and at the same time getting an enormous amount of publicity. But I guess that was too radical a concept for it. The problem is the things that we took away from Sea Shepherd when we left are the three most valuable things, and that's courage and imagination and passion. They don't have that. All they have are ships and assets and a membership list.
Now, what are you right now? Are you the Paul Watson Foundation? Are you Neptune's Navy? Are you Sea Shepherd France? Are you all of the above?
I set up the Captain Paul Watson Foundation because they can't really, you know, it's pretty hard to take over something with my name on it. But our operational name was Neptune's Navy, which is something I created years ago. But then they started putting out merchandise with Neptune's Navy saying they, because I created that while I was a Sea Shepherd, they own the rights to it, is what they're saying. So then I said, okay, well, we'll call it Neptune's Pirates because they're not going to take that name because they're scared to death of the word pirates. So we called it Neptune's Pirates.
Wow. So that's a lot of different names. What I kept thinking of when you were talking about being taken, you know, not having your own image be considered part of the Sea Shepherd brand, I kept flashing on like the John Fogerty Creedence Clearwater legal fights of John Fogerty being told he sounded too much like Creedence Clearwater Revival to actually release his own albums.
Yeah. Well, it's also the same with Steve Jobs and Apple and, various people who are thrown out of the organizations that there are companies that they found.
So right now, Neptune's Pirates, I know you've got an action planned in Iceland. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, last year we brought the John Paul DeJoria to Iceland, and the day we arrived, the Icelandic government imposed a temporary ban on Icelandic whaling, which meant that we couldn't do anything, but we were happy to have the ban, so we then moved on to the Faroe Islands. But while in the Faroe Islands, in disrupting the killing of pilot whales there, the Faroese made a complaint to Denmark, and Denmark made a complaint to Jamaica, and they took our flag away, so we didn't have a flag on the ship. So while reflagging, the temporary ban ended at the end of August, and they went out and killed 24 whales out of Iceland, but we couldn't get there because we didn't have a flag on the ship. But now we've reflagged, and we're going to be heading to back to Iceland in June. Now, the Icelandic government is against whaling. The Icelandic people are against whaling. But the most powerful, politically influential, and wealthiest man in Iceland is a man named Christian Lofsson, and he owns the whaling fleet. And he swore that he'll do anything to continue whaling. He's now asked for a 10-year permit to continue doing it. He's 80 years old, but he just loves to kill whales. He's a modern-day Captain Ahab. So last year when they had the temporary ban, he actually threatened to bring the government of Iceland down And he's got the support of the Independence Party, and he seduced the Green Party to support him. Green Party of Iceland supporting whaling. So what happens is that in light of that, they're now demanding this permit, and that's under review, and he's confident he's going to get it. We intend to make sure that those ships don't get to a single whale. So it's going to be a risky campaign, probably involving confrontations with the Icelandic Coast Guard, whatever. But we're going to stay outside that 12-mile limit, and any whaling ship that comes out, we're going to block. And that's is going to be the strategy and prevent them. My object is a zero kill quota out of Iceland this summer. So we'll have three vessels, two smaller ones and one larger one. That's the objective. And if in the event that Iceland cancels it again, then we'll just move everything to the Faroe Islands. But in the meantime, we're also having a land crew going to the Faroe Islands in the summer to disrupt the killing of pilot whales and dolphins there. So it's going to be a very challenging summer.
Do you get the sense that the temporary ban coinciding with your arrival was not a coincidence? That it was like, yeah, if Paul Watson's here with a boat, let's just avoid the bad PR?
Well, I can't say that for a fact, but I know in 2019 when we showed up, they did the same thing. They canceled the hunt as soon as we showed up. I don't think they want that confrontation. And I'm not really concerned about being arrested. Say I get arrested in Iceland. What Iceland's doing is illegal. And we'll just turn it around to putting themselves on trial. Because in 1986, we sank half of Iceland's whaling fleet and destroyed their whale processing plant. And that might sound illegal, but I made myself available for charges. I went to Iceland. They refused to charge me. They told me to leave the country. The Minister of Justice at the time said, who the hell does he think he is? He comes into our country and demands to be arrested. Get him out of here. So there was no criminal charges because there could be no crime because there were no charges. But the reason that they did that was they knew that to put me on trial would be to put Icelandic whaling on trial before the world court, and they were reluctant to do it. So maybe now they'll charge us and we'll get the opportunity to finally go to court and put them on trial.
Wow. Now, what is happening with the documentary series? I gather that the cameras are the cameras now leaving Sea Shepherd and following you? What's going on?
I don't know what I don't think there was Sea Shepherd. We had a documentary crew last year. We'll have another documentary crew here. The Whale War show ended in 2015 because, you know, Japan left the Southern Ocean. However, it looks like they're going to return. And if they do, then we'll be back there to confront them once again. We'll be producing another, it'll be called Neptune's Pirates instead of being called Whale Wars, but we're going to continue to do that. Well, the problem for Sea Shepherd is to do something like that is that they don't have the action. You can't have a TV show without action. And super trawlers taking pictures of krill fishing vessels is not very much action. For instance, we just had a super trawler campaign and people are saying, well, you're criticizing a Sea Shepherd for doing the krill fishery and just taking pictures, but that's what you guys did over the last couple of months in the English Channel and off the coast of Ireland. But that's not exactly true. We were out there doing video, but also we were getting evidence, hard evidence of their illegal activities. For instance, we caught super trawlers fishing inside the 12-mile limit of France and of the UK. And that evidence was turned over to the French governments who are going to, you know, press charges on that. So that's still direct action. But, you know, we can't physically intervene inside the 200-mile limit, but we can deliver real hard evidence to the governments about crimes that are being committed. In fact, it was very embarrassing for the French government because on the very day that the French Minister of the Sea was on television saying these trawlers do not operate inside the 12-mile limit, at that very day, we were documenting a trawler fishing 11 miles off the coast of Normandy.
Wow. Now, the krill fishery strikes me as particularly terrifying. Am I wrong on that? Just the idea of removing the smallest things from the ocean and figuring out how to do that seems phenomenally dangerous to me.
Well, of course, it's undermining the food pyramid for all other fishes in the ocean. And, you know, and that, of course, affects every phytoplankton, zooplankton, everything. But why are they doing this? Because nobody eats krill. It's turned into a protein paste for feeding salmon on salmon farms and for factory farm chickens and pigs. So it's basically a fish meal industry. Now, here's an interesting thing about Sea Shepherd's involvement with the krill fisheries. Is they're going down and documenting these krill fishing vessels, and they're in partnership with Austral Fisheries. Austral Fisheries actually buys salmon from a company in Scotland. That company in Scotland buys krill fish meal from a company in Australia, which comes from Antarctica. But Sea Shepherd isn't mentioning anything about that because they don't want to criticize Austral fisheries. So I think it's another reason to show that Sea Shepherd has been completely compromised by these corporations.
Wow. What are the other campaigns you're working on? Or is this just smaller because you only have the one ship now?
No, we're working on getting a second ship. And we're also focusing on the end of the year to go after the Japanese whalers when they return. Now, why do I think they're returning is that they scrapped the Nishan Maru, the factory ship, and they just spent $150 million to rebuild a new factory whaling ship. Now, there's only one purpose for a factory ship, and that's to go to the Southern Ocean. Don't need it off the coast of Japan. So that's what I think that they intend to do. And I've been doing interviews with journalists in Japan who have said that that looks like what's going on. They can't prove it, but what are they going to do with this big factory ship? So we want to be in a situation or at the end of this year, or if it happens next year, that we'll be in a position to confront them once again. My only concern on this new factory ship will be probably faster, and we'll have to look at being able to equal their speed.
What would be the justification for the factory ship? Has anybody bothered to explain why it's happening? Or just, felt like building a factory ship?
Well, they didn't give any explanation. It's the Japanese government. They don't have to. But there is really no other reason to have a factory ship than to go down to the Southern Ocean. They have coastal whaling in Japan, which is illegal under international law, but coastal whaling doesn't require a factory ship. It just doesn't need
it. Sorry, so it's the government of Japan building the ship?
The Japanese whaling company is owned by the government of Japan.
Okay. What's the logic? Because my understanding is there isn't a huge market for whale anymore.
Well, there's no market. It's hugely subsidized, and now even more subsidized with the construction of this boat. Because after Japan nationalized the whaling company, what they did was put on the board of directors of that whaling company former politicians, who all now get like six-figure salaries to sit on the board of this whaling company. Now you get rid of whaling, these people no longer have a job. Now let's take a look at the crews that work on these ships. They belong to unions that are controlled by the Yakuza. And the Yakuza has a lot of power in Japan in the government. So it's a combination of Yakuza-controlled unions and politicians on the board of the Japanese government-owned whaling company. That's the reason for this going. There's no money to be made from it, except for the politicians and the sailors on the boats. So it's subsidized. But, that's not unusual. Globally, industrialized fishing only exists because of about $90 billion in subsidies. It wouldn't exist otherwise. It couldn't exist. Now, if you go into any fish market anywhere in the world, you'll see plenty of fish. And people say, well, there's no shortage of fish. So what are you talking about? And what I'm talking about is the fact that it takes incredible amount of resources to get those fewer and fewer fish. So 40, 50 years ago, we didn't have $150 million super trawlers. We didn't have 100-mile long lines. We didn't have giant purse seine nets. We didn't have 100-mile long gill nets. It takes this incredible amount of money to buy all this technology in order to catch the fewer and fewer fish that are there. So at this rate, we're going to fish them all out and fish species after becoming commercially extinct. During the 1980s, I predicted that the northern cod fishery would collapse, and everybody said I was wrong. The Canadian government said, we have the best scientists in the world. You don't know what you're talking about. We have the best computer models and everything. And in 92, the whole thing collapsed, and it's never recovered. The Orange Ruffy fishery collapsed in 1990s. It's never recovered. And so what they do is they just replace one species with another species, and you just forget about the species that's gone and move on to something else. So to the point where, like I remember in the 60s and 70s, pollock, nobody ate pollock. It was a non-commercial fish. The reason being, it's completely tasteless. It has no taste at all. And then they came up with this idea, well, let's take the pollock and we'll put this chemical dye on it and a chemical taste, and we'll sell it and market it as surimi or artificial crab. And that's where that big market came from. And so now the pollock were no longer safe. Toothfish, which is sold as Chilean sea bass, is not from Chile, and it's not a bass, but it's a good marketing term. Who wants to buy a toothfish, But that species is now endangered, but is still being fished. And Austral Fisheries is one of the companies that specializes in going after Patagonian Australian toothfish. It's all comes down to marketing. You know, back in the 50s, 60s, they had this thing up in Alaska called the spider crab, but nobody wanted to eat a spider crab. So they just changed the name to Alaska king crab, and suddenly they had a market. And so that's what they keep doing. It doesn't work all the time. I know with gooey ducks, when they try to change it to a queen clam, it just didn't catch on. But this is what they try to do. But we're overfishing the ocean. That's why in 2015 at the Global Conference on Climate Change, COP21, I said, what we need is at least a 75-year moratorium on industrialized mechanized fishing to allow the ocean to recover from the damage that we've done to it. And because if we don't, it won't recover. Now, here's the most scary thing of all. Since 1950, there's been a 40% diminishment in phytoplankton in the sea. And that can be verified through articles in Scientific America on that. Now, 40% diminishment since 1950. And this is phytoplankton, marine aquatic plants. And these aquatic plants provide up to 70% of the oxygen in the air we breathe. Absolute necessity. If phytoplankton disappears from the ocean, we die. It's as simple as that. We do not live on this planet without phytoplankton. And that's why I say when the ocean dies, we die. Now, why is phytoplankton being diminished? It's being diminished because we're killing off the farmers of the ocean. Those species that provide the nutrients for the phytoplankton, the iron, the magnesium, and the nitrogen. And those species are whales and dolphins and seabirds and fishes. And that every day, one blue whale dumps 3 tons of manure or feces into the sea, heavily rich in those iron and nitrogen and magnesium. So when you reduce whale, dolphin, seabird populations, reduce the nutrient base for phytoplankton, which leads to the diminishment of phytoplankton populations. So really what we're forgetting is that we cannot live on this planet outside of the three basic laws of ecology. The first is the law of diversity. The strength of an ecosystem is dependent upon diversity within it. The second is the law of interdependence, that all species within an ecosystem are interdependent with each other. And the third is the law of finite resources, that there's a limit to growth, a limit to carrying capacity. And when we steal the carrying capacity from other species, that leads to the diminishment of interdependence and diversity, which leads to ecological collapse. Basically, we're ecologically ignorant. And unless we learn to educate ourselves, we're not going to survive.
What else really scares you right now?
Well, that's the most important thing, is that the death of the ocean, which is quite a possibility. We're always very good at reacting to things, but not very good at anticipating things. And the other thing that humans are very good at is what I call adaptation to diminishment. Now, this is something that served us well 10, 12, 20,000 years ago, and we had to adapt to diminishment. But now what happens is we just move on. We've adapted to it. We just move on. The species disappeared. We got another species we can go after. For instance, in 1960s, if I had said to you, that in 40 years you're going to be buying water in plastic bottles and paying more for that water than the equivalent amount of gasoline, you would have looked at me like, I'm crazy. Nobody would do that. But hell, now we live in a world where you buy water in plastic bottles and it's actually weight for weight worth more than gasoline.
Wow. Anything else you want to make sure that you mention?
Well, I think the other thing that I've done 2 years ago, I established my own church. It's not a religious thing.
Yes, I meant to ask you about that, the Church of Biocentrism.
Yeah, so it's more of a scientific-based thing, but it's built around those three basic laws of ecology. And I think that this is really the root cause of all of our problems. About 8 to 10,000 years ago, with the development of agriculture, we developed anthropocentric religions, which, in fact, every single major religion on the planet today is anthropocentric. It puts humans at the front and center. It was all created for us. Everything is here for us, and we're the only species that matters. And therefore, I think that we have to develop a biocentric outlook, which a lot of indigenous people understand, and that is we're part of everything, that we're just as equal to, or sometimes a species more equal than us, more important than us. I mean, I got a call from a reporter from Fox a few years ago, Brett Hume, who's still there with him, I guess, and he said, did you say that you gave a talk and you said that bees, trees, worms, and fish were more important than people? I said, yeah, I said that. And he said, how could you say something so outrageous? I said, well, because they're more important than people. Because of the very simple fact that they can live here without us, but we can't live here without them. We don't live in a world without bees or without worms, without fish or without trees. They're far more important than we are. So we have to get over that. Basically, what are we? We're a bunch of overly, egotistical overly conceited naked apes who've become divine legends in our own minds. You know, I even renamed it as Homo arrogantis ignoramus.
What has the response been to your religion?
Oh, got about 600, you know, members of the church. But you have to start small. Now, I think if you can get people to believe in Mormonism, Scientology, get people to follow anything. But the basis, we're not really a religion. You know, I'm just joking on that. I think there was a guy who tried to spook the Mormons and the Scientologists because he said that he created the flying spaghetti monster, and that's it became a religion. You know, people take that religion seriously today now. And in fact, in New Zealand, they actually got permission to wear colanders on their heads on their driver's license because that was their religious right to do so. And the guy who created this flying spaghetti monster religion just threw his hands up and said, see, people will believe in anything. But what I'm offering is not a belief system. What I'm offering with the Church of Biocentrism is an understanding based purely on scientific principles, ecological principles of how we should live on this planet. And that is, we should live in harmony with all other species. And we have to understand that we're not greater or more important or more significant than any other species. And I don't even think we're the most intelligent species. A few years ago, I was debating a Norwegian whaler, and he said to me, Wasson, you say that whales are more intelligent than people. How can you say such a stupid thing? And I said, well, George, his name is George, he's head of the High North Alliance. I said, George, I measure intelligence by the ability to live in harmony with the natural world, and by that criteria, whales are far more intelligent than we are. And he said, well, yeah, by that criteria, cockroaches are more intelligent than we are. I said, George, you're beginning to understand what I'm talking about. You know, cockroaches have been here for 300 million years.
Wow. I'm fascinated by what we're going to find out with AI being able to monitor all of these things that scientists are so reluctant to call languages. Because the modeling, the fact that we're turning up different animals who clearly have names for each other.
Oh, yeah.
And are clearly saying things.
In November, a team in the Bering Strait using AI was able to have a conversation with a humpback whale. And so that's a major breakthrough. So, you know, we do know that dolphins have names for each other. Dolphins have actually learned to use English words and identify what they were. And actually, I read a story about a gray parrot who actually was able to understand and ask a question. And the question, because he was able to put the words together, the question was, what color am I? And then when he was told gray, he then understood gray. And that, so which is, I've never heard of any other animal being able to ask a question before. But the problem is that we don't know what these animals are capable of because we don't know how to communicate with them. I'm sure that every species is able to communicate quite well with their own kind. Bees communicate brilliantly with each other. Ants communicate. A lot of this is done. I mean, trees communicate. They communicate through a fungal network of and using chemicals. For instance, if a virus breaks out on one end of the forest, say 50 miles away, all of a sudden antibodies within a few days are being found in trees 100 miles away because obviously they've communicated the problem. And they're developing the antibodies to deal with that problem. So I think that almost every species of plant and animal is able to communicate on some level, whether that be through fungal networks, through smell, through chemicals, or through auditory signals or whatever, they're capable of doing that.
Yeah, I think our entire species is in for a bit of an awakening as AI gets better at translating what animals are saying.
Of course, there's a downside of AI, too.
Oh, many, many, many downsides.
Yeah.
But in terms of communication with other species and tracking down, you know, because I've been following that research as well around speaking humpback and breaking down, you know, all these new stories about breaking down whale song.
I think it's certainly going to happen. I read something the other day, too. It says, the most frightening thing that you could imagine is some aliens coming down, going into the ocean, spending 2 days there, and then leaving. You know, other words, we're not even worth talking to.
Yeah, I think that's a perfect place for us to end this off.
But also the other thing too is that anthropocentrism, this anthropocentric way of thinking, is not only the root cause of our destruction of ecological systems, it's also the root cause of war and all that we're seeing going on. We've been at perpetual war ever since the development of these anthropocentric religions. And we have to get rid of them, or else we're just simply not going to survive. And we have to understand what is truly valuable. And what is truly valuable is nature and all the other species, that diversity, that interdependence of all other species that we share on that. And that's the only way we're really going to survive. But we can't have a viewpoint that it was all created for us and that we're the only species that matters.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mark.
Thanks again for checking out Scanna with Mark Laren Young and our special guest, my favorite eco-pirate, Captain Paul Watson. I'd like to thank all our sponsors and Patreon patrons and some of the people and organizations who have helped us through personal donations and Substack, including Louise Moon, Howard Garrett, Rowena Ray, Robert Anderson, Susie Venuta, Simon McNair, Yosef Wask, our friends at Eagle Wing Whale Watching and Wildlife Tours, and Orca Publishing, publishers of my 3 books on orcas and 2 on sharks for younger readers. These books, including a couple of baby books, are available everywhere. Please follow us on Substack and social media and share the show with your friends. Share it with absolutely everyone. And sharing our work is more essential than ever because social media sites are making it tougher than ever to find Scanna and pretty much all Canadian news. Because of that, the Scanna newsletter now does a monthly issue sharing stories about all things eco and aquatic from Canadian media outlets. If this podcast did not work for you, you've been listening to Tucker Carlson. And shame on you. Scanna is stationed in Saanich, BC, territories of the Wasanich, Songhees, and Esquimalt peoples. Our executive producer, our always awesome Admiral Rain Banu. Researcher, Captain Courtney Bill, audio magic, and so much more, courtesy of Commodore Bug Lewis. Scanna's theme song, Scanna, is by Leah Abramson.